best friend is his mother. Hello, and welcome to Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other amateur detectives as masterpieces. I am Nick, the master of suspense of this podcast, and I am joined as ever by Roger.
I guess I'm the homeless guy. Yeah, absolutely.
You're the Hitchcock blonde, Roger. though we don't have them in all of these. You may notice my voice is a little shredded, but hopefully not too unpleasant to listen to. Possibly more pleasant than normal. But we are
You need
having...
a better quality of vodka, mate.
you made me cough with your vodka reference. So we are, as you may have gathered by our opening, delving back into the mighty chest of Alfred Hitchcock. That was much weirder than I made it sound. Very Hitchcockian, in fact. We are going to do a couple of films in this podcast and then a couple more after that. But we are starting with the one film that everyone thinks of with Hitchcock. I think it's probably his most famous creation. I would say so.
At least if they are not... Not offending anybody in particular, pretentious film types the way we are becoming. I think it is the one that a typical film goer will first think of.
Yes, I think that's fair. And we are, of course, talking of 1960s Psycho. We have another film later, which is Rear Window, if you want to wait for the second half of the podcast. But the first half, we will be discussing Psycho.
And the usual warnings, there will be thoroughgoing spoilers. I mean...
many spoilers.
If there is anything you still don't know about the plot, then, you know, you'd be trying really hard and you're probably not listening to this at all, but...
Yes, absolutely. So this is... well, of course, it's directed by Alfred Hitchcock. We have, so, I mean, the Hitchcock films we've talked about before were North by Northwest, The Birds, Vertigo. They all have classic Hitchcock blondes, about who we probably talked about much more and probably will remain so in the previous time we discussed Hitchcock, because they're not so much of a feature particularly. Actually, with Psycho and Rear Window, they are a bit more. But we start with Janet Leigh, who is an alumnus of Ribbon of Memes because she was in the piratey murder ghost stabby thing that I've temporarily forgotten the name of.
The Fog.
The Fog, thank you. Along with her daughter, Jamie Leigh Curtis. But this is Janet Leigh, some years before, as a secretary for a realtor.
Yeah.
Who is handed $40,000 back in 1960 to take to the bank. And she's outwardly utterly respectable. We realise she's less respectable by some very racy scenes. Now, remind me when the Hays Code was removed.
It was technically still in force, but it was clearly crumbling. I mean, a thing that was specifically forbidden was two people in bed when they weren't married.
Well,
so.
Are they actually, knowing Hitchcock, he probably never had them technically in bed. I think her lover is sitting on the edge of the bed, maybe. Or so. Anyway,
one of the lines that they wanted to censor was when she says to her lover, put your shoes on, because that implies that he had his trousers off.
Very good. So we have a racy scene in a bedroom. In fact, this film slightly reminds me of From Dusk Till Dawn, because it's a film that suddenly gets hijacked by an entirely different film halfway through.
Have you read the novel?
Robert Bloch's novel. I think I have many years ago, but can remember very little about it. But my memory is there's very little of this early stuff. Is
well,
that right?
Yes and no. The thing to me is that... one of the things I can see to learn more about Hitchcock's approach to the film, insofar as, you know, he exerted influence on scriptwriters and so on as well, obviously, is to compare it with the novel. And, well, first of all, I have a theory about this. And Bloch himself said, by the mid-1940s, I'd pretty well mined the vein of ordinary supernatural themes and that it had become varicose, realised as a result of what went on during World War II and reading the more widely disseminated work in psychology, the real horror is not in the shadows, but in the twisted little world inside our own skulls.
Right.
And the way I see it, slightly more simplistically than that perhaps, is that, you know, pre-war horror is basically the Manor de Mar James ghost story, the old dark house, a child of Lavinia's calling its father's name on top of Sentinel Hill, and so on. And
things,
you know,
outside of humanity.
And a significant part of the audience had been to Burma or Auschwitz, and if they hadn't, they'd read about them. Yeah. And, you know, that sort of real human horror, as you've mentioned, your distaste of murder mysteries, it just doesn't stand up to, no, humans did this without any supernatural weirdness. They just did this to each other because they could.
Yeah.
And I think that is why the novel was a success. It is rumoured that after buying the film rights, Hitchcock tried to buy up every copy of the novel to keep the story secret, but the only person who actually claimed this is Hitchcock. So...
That has slightly triggered me to think of a similar quote by none other than Clarence Darrow, the famous lawyer from the 1920s. And the reason that springs to mind as you say that is one of his defences for Leopold and Loeb, who we will be discussing more in a later podcast, I suspect, but they were two young men who killed to prove that they could kill and get away with it. And Darrow's response was very much that humanity had changed after the war, his defence against the death penalty. And it just struck me, as you were saying that, is basically that war has warped humanity. One of the parts of his defence was, it will take 50 years to wipe it out of the human heart, if ever. I know this, that after the Civil War, crimes of this sort increased marvellously. No one needs to tell me that crime has no cause. It has as definite a cause as any other disease, and I know that out of the hatred and bitterness of the Civil War, crime increased in America and has never seen... crime increased as America had never seen before. I know that Europe is going through the same experience today. I know it has followed every war, and I know it has influenced these boys, so that life was not the same to them as it would have been if the world was not made red with blood. So that's just a little bolster to your point.
I mean, I could argue slightly against that, but yeah.
Well,
we're not a psychology podcast or a culture podcast. Definitely
well,
not
he was a
culture
lawyer.
Podcast.
With an ulterior motive.
Yeah.
But it was.
And anyway, the reason I mentioned the book specifically, I will come back and mention occasional differences from it, is that Marion Crane is in two chapters out of seven of the book.
Right.
Whereas she is in half the film.
Yes. Yeah. That was my memory, that it's a similar sort of shape of film, of story, but we have a long secret. So Marion takes the money, it's one of those where it's a really good, a bit like From Dusk Till Dawn, except the first film is one you'd rather see than the second film. The early part of the film is really classic. You get how good Hitchcock was with tension. Like, we get the moment where she said she's going home ill and she drives out of the city and bumps into a boss, just walking across the sidewalk, and he sees her in the car. And she's got the 40 grand in her car, but he doesn't know that at the time. And then we get this lovely sequence with the cop pulling her over because she's fallen asleep in her car.
So I'd just like to point out that Roger's Crime Corner has been spending a few months in Costa Rica for technical reasons, but I think this is a good example. She's not she wasn't intending to commit the crime until the instant that she did it.
Yes.
She, you know, all the various things have lined up. You know, she wants to spend more time with her lover and not meet in dodgy hotels, and she wants actually to get married. He would be quite happy to do this, but he is basically in debt, particularly paying alimony to his ex-wife. Shocking there.
I know, another bit of horror for the Hayes game.
But basically he's saving up money, and I think in the novel he's going to get his own shop or something of that nature. But in any case, he feels that, you know, I've just got this one room apartment right now because I'm saving money for that. I can't get you married into that. And then she is suddenly presented with, you've got this money.
Yeah, literally handed
in cash
the money to solve all her problems.
And in the novel, I think she's less sympathetic. I think one of the things Hitchcock deliberately does is make her more sympathetic here.
She's clearly not a career criminal, and she's clearly haunted by her deeds, by her, you know, relatively trivial deed in the scope of...
Yeah, but this is where we come back to Roger's Crime Corner, because she hasn't planned it.
Yes.
The obvious thing is going to happen, you know, on Monday morning or whenever, the boss is going to say, well, where is she? Also, did that money get to the bank? Oh, yes. It didn't. Okay, well, let's put out a watch for her. And you know, there is no way she can get away with this. Unless she vanishes completely, changes her name, all the rest of it. And there's no sign that she's done any preparation for that. So
it was a spur of the, well, exactly. And then she starts making really silly mistakes, like buying a new car on the basis of, not being in an old car because her old car's been spotted. And it's,
all of which leaves a convenient trail, which we'll come back to.
Yes. But she then pulls up in Bates Motel, the most famous motel, I would say, in all of cinema history.
Second night on the road, having slept by the side of the road and been rousted the first night.
Yes. And she meets Norman Bates, again, one of cinema's most famous movie creations. Now, had you encountered Norman Bates before, Roger? Had you seen this film?
I had not seen the film before. I mean, I was familiar with the basic plot outlined through cultural osmosis, and as I say, I'd read the book. This is the really interesting thing. Marion's a bit more sympathetic here, but Norman is way more sympathetic. In the book, he is clearly a creep.
And
not in the cute way.
Well, I mean, here he is a creep, and he says some creepy things, but he's got this really, and it's very, it's very Ted Bundy-esque, I suppose, in that he's got this really charming, disarming smile, and this very boyish quality, which he doesn't, it's really good acting, because, you know, it's not, miscast, right? He manages to make all of that work into a believable person.
I'll point out Ted Bundy hasn't done his thing yet.
Has he not? Okay, well, he may have done something. He hasn't been found out for doing his thing yet.
But yeah, that's the thing, that in the book, again, it's a horror book, straightforwardly. I'm not saying it's bad. It does its job very well. But there is no doubt that this guy is a creep. There are explicit mentions of the horrible pornography he looks at when he's on his own, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Oh, and also he's into the occult, so, you know, obviously.
Oh, what a bastard.
We all know about them. And while we... I think in that first stage, before the murder that we see, there is some thought of, well, clearly this is not a great situation for the guy, but maybe he's just, you know, very shy and shut in and doesn't meet women very much.
Well, we know he's a mummy's boy.
Yeah.
We already know that. It's a tricky one to approach from a fresh audience kind of view, because, you know who Norman Bates is, you know, even if you've not seen the film, as you say, you know the premise. And I think even in 1960, a lot of people will have known going in the basic
though this
idea.
This was one of the films that got the gimmick of nobody will be admitted to the film once it's begun.
Yeah, but that was a marketing thing, wasn't it? Really?
I think so.
Hitchcock was very good at that sort of thing. So it's hard to approach it from, if I knew nothing about this, what would I think of this guy? But it actually, although I say it's hard to approach it, it's quite easy to be deceived by him even then, because he is so endearing. And
I think it's a really great acting job here.
Yeah.
It's adding significantly to what was in the book.
It is a real shame, because I think it is a real fine performance. The reason I say it's a real shame is because it's such a good performance. It massively typecast Anthony Perkins, who struggled to get out of the shadow of this. And I've seen him in a few other things, and he's genuinely a very good actor in all of them. But here he's just... It's a fantastic performance. And as you say, it's fascinating that pretty soon our sympathies flip to him and not to her. He's obviously a little bit prudish and slightly, not, he's so polite about it, but is he a little concerned and suspicious that she may be a sort of a loose woman or something and trying to be nice about it. And it actually takes our sympathy away from her and towards him a bit.
Mm. She meanwhile, under the pangs of what an old-fashioned person would call conscience, and frankly I would too, but also perhaps fear of being caught, has decided after her conversation with him,
yes,
that in the morning she's going to go back and give the money back and apologise, and, you know, she's not done anything like this before, she can probably get away with that.
And she probably would,
yeah.
Probably. But it's not to be, because then we have, as I keep saying, one of the most famous scenes in movie history. We have the shower scene, which is, now this you probably are familiar with and have probably seen in some way or another.
No, but I've seen umpteen million parodies of it.
Yes, yeah.
Including one too. In, I've forgotten the name of the thing, it was a horror show, TV series. Including Jamie Lee Curtis by this time, because it was quite recent, as the dean of the college or something like that, murders in the sorority house, and there is a shower scene, and she is in it, and she made sure they got it absolutely shot for shot identical.
Well, it is it's very in something of a theme for this episode. It's quite voyeuristic, you know. We are. We're just sort of standing there watching her in the shower, and it's kind of gratuitous. I mean, not gratuitous by today's standards, but there is no reason for this, for us to be basically, male gazing over, Janet Leigh's body.
I think a lot of the film is like that. I mean, just before that is the third time we have seen her in her underwear.
Yeah. yes.
And, yeah, I've seen analyses of this which suggest that it's inviting the viewer to become complicit in the, psychologically speaking, rape and murder, all considered as one thing, though yeah, there's no actual raping involved. I'm not convinced by that. It is quite male-gazy, but...
I agree. You can over-argue this complicity and voyeurism, and we will talk about it more in Rear Window for sure. I feel like, you know, ultimately you're just sitting watching a film and you're not, you don't have a choice as to, well, you know, realistically most people would turn away and not stand and watch that. But the fact that we don't turn off the film and don't turn away apparently makes us more complicit.
That's a concept we'll come back to later in the episode, of course.
Yes, yes. Regardless, then we have the murder, the famous, no knives are seen entering the body and it's all done with chocolate sauce in it. With the striking Bernard, what's his name? Bernard Harriman? Herman, thank you.
Who also, in Ribbon of Memes terms, wrote scores for Citizen Kane, The Day the Earth Stood Still, and North by Northwest.
Interesting, though I couldn't bring any of those to mind, but everyone knows the psycho stabby. And it's very, I mean, it's just it's a very effective combination of the, you know, the striking, literally striking score and the jump cuts and the, but the most disturbing thing, and for, not really the thing I think about when I think of the shower scene, the most disturbing thing really is the close up on her eye at the end, her open eye on the floor afterwards. How did you feel about the technical, it's worth discussing because this is a classic movie scene.
Yeah, I think in 1960 it is fair to say that it's objective is to shock.
Yes.
And as previously discussed, the threshold for shocking always gradually increases.
Yes.
So it is not as effective now as it would be then, but it still works.
From that point on, the movie that we've been watching is over. You know, we were interested in the story of Marion Crane. She's been killed. And it's a bit of a Charles Dexter Ward situation. In our protagonist has ended. And we are now following Norman.
He's the bridge between the two films, yeah.
Yes, yeah. As he discovered, oh God, mother, there's blood, mother, what have you done?
Yeah, so this is the second layer of deception, if you like. That yes, he knows that there are murders going on here, but you are clearly being channeled into thinking that he knows that his mother gets a bit stabby, particularly with attractive young women, and he's covering up for her, which I guess you could consider a positive thing in it for him, even if it's not clearly a thing one would ask people to emulate.
He's trying to protect his mum, though you still remain sort of sympathetic to him, but, you know, he doesn't call the police or anything. He goes straight to Roger's body disposal corner. How does he rate on the body disposal corner, Roger?
Yeah, I mean, if there is no reason to look in the swamp, then something down in the swamp will do nicely.
I
do like that fake out where it looks as if the car's going to float in the puddle he's pushed it into.
He uses the shower curtain.
Shower curtain body bag in cinematic
history? Well, you get the horrible impression he knows what he's doing, really. it's well done. Now, so the second half of the film becomes the investigation. So we slightly switch to after we've followed Norman's clean-up operation, we switch to Sam, her lover, and Detective Arbogast, as well as Vera, who's the sister, who sort of becomes the...
Her character is Lila, but she's played by Vera Miles.
I forget, because these characters, I suppose apart from Detective Arbogast, these characters are more forgettable and less well-drawn. Lila... It just sort of becomes a stand-in Marion in a way. She's not really much of a character by herself.
Well, in the book, by the end of it, she's getting a thing together with Sam. So that was a thing that was explicitly removed because, let's face it, it's only been a few days, Guy.
It would have been a bit... even then, it's slightly... just by the fact that they forged such a friendship, it's ever so slightly icky just from that point of view, I suppose. I find the second half of the film less compelling in a way. I will say, so I saw this film when I was a very young chap, and
it's guided your life.
I genuinely developed a fear of going upstairs, because what happens to Detective Arbogast, who follows this very obvious trail Marion has left behind. In fact, she got so close, she's only 10 or 15 miles, I think, from where her lover lives, is that right? Which is how he tracks down her lover, the detective. But he goes into the Bates house and climbs up the stairs and is stabbed in the chest. And something about just going upstairs in a dark house just got to me as a kid. So that I found much more effective than the shower scene for me. I don't know if it's a better scene, but it certainly got to me.
It's also very sudden. I mean, the shower scene, we have a lot of build-up. I mean, some of it lingering over generally in her underwear, as previously mentioned, but also, you know, she's gradually getting into the shower. There's the shadow coming in from outside. The curtain is pulled back.
We don't get Detective Arbogast in his underwear, ever.
Whereas here, it's just, he's going up the stairs, he's nearly at the top of the stairs, and suddenly, whoop, this figure comes out of the next door room and stabs him.
Yes, it's... I think you're right. It's just the speed and the shock of it that there's no build up. So your defences aren't up. You're just like, whoa, whoa. Yeah. So that one got me more.
And it's worth noting, I think, he has been quite sensibly sending in reports.
Yes.
The thing that is, I can't really count this as an error by Norman because it's a perfectly pardonable mistake given insufficient research, but as far as he is concerned, you know, he can just say either she never got here or she got here, she left in the morning. And no suspicion should attach to him. However, he doesn't know about the $40,000.
Yes.
Whereas Arbogast and the others do. And therefore, their assumption is that he killed her to steal the money.
For the money, yes.
And therefore, they have a bit more interest in him than they really should.
The money, of course, being one of Hitchcock's MacGuffins in the thing that drives the plot that is actually not relevant in itself to the plot.
Yeah, I do find it a bit heavy-handed that you know, let us zoom in on the money lying there in the bedroom, and then he goes back and gets it, that kind of thing. And then he just chucks it in the boot of the car with everything else.
And let's see, it's down in the lake. After that, I mean, I do like the confrontation. So Sam and Norman have a bit of a dance where it's quite clear that something funny has gone on, and Sam's very suspicious, and Anthony loses some of his charm there, and his sort of facade cracks a little bit. And I like that. I mean, it's all... John Gavin, who was, he does a solid acting job, I guess, but Anthony Perkins is, he's, what I like in that conversation, he's a different character, but he's still Norman Bates. He's just, you know, reacting to, like we all are with different people.
They find the crucial clue, which was, okay, this is completely lost on a modern audience, but this is arguably the first time that a toilet was seen on screen on a mainstream film.
Yes, not being used, of course, but yes.
Being flushed,
goodness me, yes.
Basically...
Yeah, not to get rid of... anyway.
Lila was, having decided that she was going to give up and turn herself in, working out how much she'd spend out of the $40,000, $700 on the car and so on, yeah, and therefore how much she could hand back, and she tore up her notes on that and flushed them down the toilet, but one bit that started 40,000 didn't get flushed.
Yes. And the crucial clue that she's been there, and it looks like Norman's tried to destroy some evidence, even though he had nothing to do with the money and he didn't know anything about that.
Yeah, and Sam and Lila find that.
And then Lila goes up to the house and makes the discovery. I mean, she looks through, I guess it's implied that she does find a book of pornography, because she looks at a book and she's a bit horrified by it, but we don't know what it is. Mm. And then we have the twist, the classic twist, that she finds the mum and she's been dead for ages, and it was all Norman dressed up. We get to the final, so Norma gets, there's a tussle,
Sam recovers from being knocked unconscious and arrives in the nick of time.
And saves the day. And then we have, I'm gonna say that the film at this point, the second half I think is less compelling, but it's still a really good film. To me, we then have one of the most deflating denouements to a film I've ever seen.
Yeah, my feeling at the time was if you were making this for the first time in the modern day, the fight in the cellar would be the end of it, and then maybe they would come out into the survivors, I should say, would come out into the sunlight, yes, or whatever, and they, thank goodness that's over, cut.
Yeah.
But we have to have it, not only explained, but by a very, even by 1960 standards, a very smug white man.
A really smug mansplainer comes out, and having spent, I don't know, 5 minutes with Norman Bates, works out absolutely the entire plot and then proceeds to explain it to us. It's a guy we've never seen before. He has zero charisma. And he just tells us in really cod psychology terms, I know exactly what's happened. Here's exactly what's going to happen to Norman from now on. It's just, to me, it really spoils the film, because it is just so, he comes out, basically, so Norman poisoned his mum, he was very protective, and then he can't cope with the fact that he killed his mum.
His father had died, his mother, several years later, got involved with another chap, he poisoned them both.
And then became his mum.
Yeah.
I mean, multiple personality sort of is vanishingly rare anyway, but I mean,
there is no case of it that has ever been reliably diagnosed.
Yeah.
It's a thing that gets claimed by defense attorneys a lot. And I mean, there are certainly cases of people hearing voices.
Schizophrenia is a thing, yeah, isn't it?
But I'm not saying it's impossible, but I think the evidence is very strongly against it at this point.
Okay, well, that was my understanding. You know,
arguably, it was less of a well-known thing. I mean, again, you know, nobody's read Olshaker because he hasn't written it yet.
But the
idea of generally knowing how this sort of killer works is alien to people. And there is, I think, a certain amount, I mean, the sort of moral warning film that was made in the height of the code, yes. which was parodied in Amazon Women on the Moon. yes. You know, here are these terrible moral traps that await young girls going to the city, and let's look at them in gruesome detail because it's a moral lesson.
Yes, and you can feel good about it and also enjoy the film.
And I think there is a certain amount of that in the psychologist's speech here.
Yes.
This guy is a weirdo. Aren't you glad you're normal?
I wonder if it was spliced in at the end. I agree. In modern terms, the audience would kind of fill in the gaps themselves. And if you don't flat out explain it, then it is creepy and weird. If you've got someone saying, oh, this is this and this is this and we see this, then it just... One, it doesn't sound right. You start to think, hang on, that's not actually how psychology works. It spoils the whole plot because then you start to think, but it's bollocks. He's absolutely wrong in the way psychology works. This was 1960s psychoanalysis.
I'm not saying you couldn't get somebody doing that to their own mind as a defense mechanism.
Yes.
But yeah.
It's better left unexplained, or at least only half explained.
Again, I think this is in the day, the audience perhaps would not have been aware of just how screwed up minds can get without any need for external whatever.
Well, I'll tell you, a good way of explaining it without smug white guy would have just been to have the last scene where we have Norman as his mother, kind of, you know, just showing what's literally happened to him. We could have had that very last scene in the jail cell. And that would have told you an awful lot about what was going on.
Yeah.
And he could have thrown in a few lines about, you shouldn't have killed me, or something like that, to explain.
But it becomes clear that the personality that's there now is Mother.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You could have done that without this tedious, it felt like a 5-minute lecture. So I don't want to go on a bit too much, because genuinely I think it's a really good,
it's not one of the great moments people quote from the film, put it that way.
I agree. First and foremost, you can talk about a lot of themes with it, but I think first and foremost, I think as with all the Hitchcocks, it's a thriller, it's a suspense thriller, and what Hitchcock wanted to do was shock and excite his audience. And trying to read too much more into it than that, I feel, is perhaps a bit foolish and unnecessary. As cinematic vehicles, it's a very good one.
Yeah, I think it's very easy now to get into the mindset of Hitchcock the great director, Hitchcock the artist.
Yes.
And forget that, no, what he was trying to do was put bums in seats.
Yes, exactly.
By whatever means were available to him.
Well, as we talked about, you know, we had this whole thing. He was incredible at PR stunts, like no one will come in the theatre after it's watched, and all that kind of stuff. He did, like with Strangers on a Train, that he was pictured sticking an L in it to make it Stranglers on a Train. He was full of all that kind of PR nonsense. So he was absolutely, first and foremost, wanted to be a commercially successful director.
So just going back a bit... He was in 59-60, he was seeing competition, you know, of other genre film directors, but he had just had, to be fair, Vertigo 58 and North by Northwest in 59. So, two reasonably successful films.
Often pretty good. This was a really low budget film, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, he'd also had two aborted projects, with Paramount. Flamingo Feather and No Bail for the Judge, about which that is frankly all I know. But he had just had two films that had started production and failed. And he needed to get something out and back quickly. And I don't know if that's why it went in black and white, but I'm sure that would have been a budgetary pressure, because it was a lot cheaper, still is, anything other than digital, but it was a lot cheaper to film in black and white.
But he does, it's quite a noir, I don't know about noir
themes,
but visually, it's noir-esque, isn't it? It makes good use of darkness and shadow and,
He borrowed his daughter for one of the roles, though it's quite a minor role. She was an actor in her own right anyway. She didn't do that much. We'll come back to her in a future episode. But Patricia Hitchcock is Marion's co-worker, Caroline.
Oh, I didn't realise that. Oh, that's interesting.
I mean, she doesn't leave any sort of impression, but to be fair, she's not supposed to leave an impression. She's the background good girl.
She doesn't.
Who would never think of stealing $40,000.
Exactly. She's not like the smug white guy at the end, so that's good.
I mean, the opening titles are interesting. It's in those days moderately challenging to do that kind of optical effect.
Right, yes.
Rather than just putting words over a background shot. And it's just a bit disconcerting, which is, I'm sure, the intended effect. That's pretty good going.
Yeah.
The thing that was puzzling me in the early part of the film is I don't know how far the production code was falling apart at this point. I mean, we know it was on its last legs. Yes. I mean, on the one hand, we have this woman with her lover who is divorced and so on. But according to the code, and an audience thinking in terms of the code would have known, you know, crime does not pay, therefore Marion's theft will not prosper.
Yeah.
Or would they have thought, maybe they can get away with that? The thing
it's
that really...
interesting at this point in the code, yeah, that you could have got... Maybe that is why Norman can't get the money as well, because he couldn't personally profit from the 40 grand.
But the thing that really struck me in that regard is she has to dig her own grave. She comes up to the motel, and the sign is on, but it's dark. There's nobody in the office. She has to hoot and call before Norman shows up. And yes. that I think, is showing it's silly, but it's trying to assign her a level of culpability in this. If she'd just driven on, everything would have been fine.
Yeah, and it does toy with that. I guess there's enough tension there that the audience thinks she might get away with it, whatever the Hays Code says.
Mm.
And as you say, the problem...
And there's a lot of work to make her sympathetic, quite apart from she looks pretty.
Yes, yeah. I mean, Janet Leigh is good in it. I don't know that she's stellar, I'm afraid to say. Actually, there are some really good actors. When she's driving and thinking it through, basically, it's just a big close-up of her face while we have a voiceover.
Or that whole sequence when she's buying the new car, where she's clearly getting very twitchy and jumping at every little thing.
Yeah, actually, I really like the salesman's performance there as well, where he goes from, hey, a new customer, to, holy shit, well, hang on, there's something very suspicious going on here. But he still sells her a new car, of course.
Mm-hmm.
It's good. But, acting chops must go to Anthony Perkins. That's just an absolutely... I don't think the film would have been anything like as successful without his performance.
Well, it's also the most challenging part. I mean, Marion Crane, yes, it's a moderately complex part, compared with, say, Lila. But yes. She doesn't have a lot to do beyond that. And
no.
Make her the heroine of the whole film. You know, she escapes and does the investigation or whatever, and she would have had more to work with. I don't know. I'm just impressed with Leigh in general here, so.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I'm perhaps being mean to her, because she doesn't have the same character arc. They're both the leads, such as they are, really carry it. As far as is this justifiably Hitchcock's most famous film, I do think it's an incredible directing performance and a great, much like M. Night Shyamalan's films, in many ways it's just a sort of confident trick that doesn't really work outside of cinema. But I do think it is a genuinely really good film. Aside from the deflating ending, and aside from the fact that we are now... in our jaded times, weary of this kind of psychodrama. I mean, there's, you know, from a 2024 perspective, there's a lot of offence to be taken from the way mental health problems are used in this film and the whole title of the film. Given all that, given, you know, how we're sick of serial killer stuff now and we've delved deeply into the human psyche from then, and they hadn't in 1960, even so, it still works as a film, and I think that's quite impressive from this distance.
Yeah, I have a note. Turn off the light before you use the peephole. One thing that did occur to me, I thought there's an awfully quick change bit in here, and in the final cut, at least, the version I watched, 1:40:46, Norman is running into the house in shirt sleeves, and... Lila is running into the cellar.
Right.
And 1:40:40, so 54 seconds later, he's coming through the door dressed as his mother, being all stabby.
He's had a lot of practice. Just the same as with the bodies. He's got the frock ready to go. He's straight over the top. He's got the wig on as well, hasn't he? Yeah.
And the makeup.
We don't see the makeup so much.
This was the second highest grossing film of 1960.
What was the first?
Spartacus.
Oh, well, which, I know which one cost more to make.
I mean, people have heard of Spartacus now, but I bet more people watch Psycho.
I think that's true. Spartacus, it's good. We should do Spartacus sometime, maybe. That's a long film. All right, well, shall we move on to our second hitch?
you know the Oar story.
The Oar story.
This is John Wayne in The Greatest Story Ever Made. Or told, or whatever. Yeah, he's the centurion. His job is to say, surely this was the Son of God. And say, did that. Okay, John, but can you do it with a bit more Oar? Thinks about it. Ah, oh, surely this was the Son of God.
Very good. Just what's more awesome than John Wayne as a centurion?
Yeah, just before we move on, I think the one of our criteria for masterpieces influence, and my goodness, the influence of this is everywhere.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's literally been shot by shot remade by Gus Van Sant.
Yeah, but he's an idiot. Within a few years, William Castle was doing Homicidal, Blood Feast, coming out. Hammer's doing its series of films starting with The Nanny. I mean, this whole, basically, the gates have been opened for human-focused horror.
Yeah, you know, you can draw a direct line from this to Seven and Dexter and all that kind of stuff. And
but also The Silence of the Lambs, of course, which is inspired by the same serial killer, Ed Gein. The Silence of the Lambs version is rather more accurate.
He may be technically a multiple killer, rather. I don't know if he qualifies.
Two that they knew about, but strongly suspected more that he'd done a good job of disposing of. So,
I mean, the actual truth of Ed Gein is deeply unpleasant.
Yes. So,
influentially, absolutely. I mean, as I say, one of the reasons I'm thoroughly bored of serial killer stuff is because Psycho was so successful that we watch it all the time.
I think we've talked before about the effect of reading The Lord of the Rings now when everything has imitated it.
Yes. I think as far as influential goes, very much so. It's also, you know, interesting to talk about the war and the effect it had on horror. And we talked about that early in the film, but I think that had an influence on this. But as a film, is it enjoyable to watch? I mean, for me, yes, it is. It's compelling.
It's heavy-handed at times.
Yes, it is. I mean, it shows its age a bit, and the ending drives me mad. but I think it's a masterpiece. I think it's fair to say, for me anyway.
I'm on the edge, but on balance, I would agree.
There's enough that's
good to outweigh the bits that really don't work.
I think it's of the Hitchcock films we've talked about so far. This is, you know, we talked about Vertigo, The Birds, and North by Northwest, which certainly we were less. They were less Hitchcocky in a way, or I was less impressed with them than I remember. This one, I do see it's very Hitchcock, and it's very evident why he was a very successful director.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to rush out using your criterion. I'm not going to sit down this afternoon and watch it again. But
yes, fair enough.
But I wouldn't be surprised if I did at some point.
I probably could. I wouldn't, but if it was on again, I'd stay for a bit of Anthony Hopkins. There we go, Freudian slip. a bit of Perkins's performance, because he is mesmerizing to watch. Let's move on to a Jimmy Stewart film.
Back in time, 6 years.
We're going back in time to Rear Window. Another contender for Hitchcock's greatest film, apparently, of all time.
I think one would take this more from the arty perspective than the crowd-pleasing, but yes.
Well, it was pretty successful at the time, but it's one of Hitchcock's experiment films, in that this is one of those, of which he did quite a few, including Lifeboat and Rope, about which more later, of a single-set film. We are on in this, so we start in a single room, It's a very nice room. And we stay there for the entire film. We never leave. And we have James Stewart, who is a war correspondent photographer, war photographer.
Yeah, I think he got his rep during the war. Now he's generally dangerous things photographer.
Yeah, that kind of from our own correspondent. But he's the photographer who accompanies them, presumably. He has broken his leg. I can't remember if they say, was it in a race?
There's a suggestion that he got out in the middle of a racetrack to get the shot.
Yes, yeah, that's it. Yes, it does mention it. But he has a unspecified broken leg. He's in plaster and he's in pyjamas for the whole film. And he does get out of the chair once, I think, towards the end of the film, but that's it.
Well, a couple of times because he's getting daily visits from a nurse who massages his back to keep him from
he's not in the chair
seizing up and so on. But it's clear he can't get around. It is a full leg cast of the type that was still used in those days, and frankly, they try not to now because it's such a problem for everything else stopping working.
I've taken a few casts off in my time and seen what they do underneath, so best not to do it. But that's in dog that can't say it hurts or it itches, and that can get pretty unpleasant. Anyway, let's move on. We've
seen them before, of course, in Vertigo, which he'd make a few years after this, and in It's a Wonderful Life. He is a leading man.
I mean, he's James Stewart. I don't know if he's ever anything else particularly.
I have a lot of time for him.
My dad cannot, but I may have mentioned it before, cannot bear him because he's always James Stewart. Fortunately, I like James Stewart, so it worked for me. There's something about his very homely, homespun American charm, kind of apple pie, pumpkin pie, there's that kind of wholesome feeling to him that I like, which they try to undercut in Vertigo and sort of, touch upon undercutting here, because the whole film is about him looking out of his window at other people.
Though also we get the same thing that we would get in Vertigo of, here is a guy who is basically a man of action, who can't be the man of action.
He is reduced to just watching. Oh, does that sound familiar to people watching the film? We talked about it a bit in Psycho, but I do wonder if it's a bit overblown, the how clever it is that we're watching a man who can only watch and we're watching, so are we complicit in it? And I think you can overdo that a bit, personally. But it is, this more so than Psycho does have things to say about voyeurism, a few things, with the caveat that it is, again, first and foremost, supposed to be a commercial film to make money. Hitchcock just, I don't know, got bored sometimes and liked to put restrictions upon himself, and sometimes that led to great films. So this one, he has the most spectacular view. He's looking out over I think it's supposed to be like Greenwich Village in New York, scape of life, a slice of life. We have huge kind of penthouse apartments, we have smaller apartments, and he's watching everyone in it. There's certainly he's keeping track of every, because he's got nothing else to do. He's sort of keeping track of the resident.
Most of whom casually leave their blinds open all the time.
Almost everyone in this film has no curtains or doesn't, unless they're actually literally murdering someone, then they shut the blinds. But for the rest of it, they
Spoilers!
Don't. Sorry.
he also has an amazing girlfriend.
He is the most disinterested in Grace Kelly. Then I don't know what is. I don't want to be like, oh my God, it's Grace Kelly. But she is, despite the fact she looks like Grace Kelly, which is helped, she is very caring and attentive and funny and smart. He seems to give zero shits about any of that, which is fair enough. You can't help who you like, but it's.
It's an interesting, before we get into what you call the primary plot, We have got this sort of emotional plot getting started of, he has been going around the world, going to incredibly dangerous, rough places and to get the shot.
Yes.
And
he's a man of action.
Yeah. And she has been staying at home in New York or wherever it is. I think it's meant to be New York, but New York famously doesn't have alleys. So anyway.
I think it's New York.
Yeah. It's got that feel to it. But, and she wants him to settle down in New York. He can clearly get a high-end photography job with his reputation. And he's saying, well, yeah, maybe eventually, but I'm still enjoying this. I don't want to settle down just yet. Which, yeah, I can sort of see his point.
Yes,
clearly it's something he's going to do eventually. And the problem is, as far as they're as far as she's concerned, well, as far as they're both concerned, if he gets married, he has to be with her all the time. The idea that he could go off and do a thing and she could get on with her life and then they would meet again is just never mentioned.
The other option is she comes along with him and he feels she's not adventurous enough for that.
Yeah, but even that takes a while to get to. But, yeah, she doesn't have much... In the early stages, at least, she doesn't have much to distinguish her from any other Hitchcock lady.
No.
Later on, she gets to do things, but...
She is, it's difficult because, you know, she looks like Grace Kelly. She is Grace Kelly. And it's hard to, think of her as just a nondescript character. But I, as far as character goes, she doesn't do a lot, at least at first. But she is, clearly besotted with him.
Mm. And this helps us as the audience to become so as well, to be fair.
Yes. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, maybe he's being a bit of an arse right now, but. She clearly loves him, therefore.
It's helped that it's James Stewart, and so he's likable anyway. It helps that Grace Kelly adores
and
him.
And he's got the little stick for scratching under his cast with.
Yeah, that's quite sweet as well. But in many ways, he's a surly, miserable bastard. But he is a man of action who has been caged, and I guess that does things to people. So, as far as the main plot goes, he is watching people, he's voyeuristically, and enjoying the woman who does her exercises, Miss Torso, she's called, the people downstairs, who are arguing, the sweet people who sleep on the balcony and have to rush in when it's raining, and Lars Thorwald and his, embedded wife, that's not the way you put it, is it? Bedridden wife, who
Raymond
disappears.
Burr. Raymond Burr in his, he's not particularly famous for anything, but he's a reliable guy you get in, usually to play the villain days.
Well, he's Ironside and Perry Mason.
He would go on
later
to be,
on
yes,
in his career.
Yeah.
But here, I didn't recognise him, honestly. He's got this with, I don't know if it's the Technicolor or what, everyone with grey hair, it looks like they've dyed their hair grey. I don't know if that's a sign of, I don't know if that's a side effect of the Technicolor or whether they have dyed their hair grey. It looks really weird, blue rinse-esque or something. Looks very strange. But he, coinciding with his wife disappearing, he goes out with several large suitcases in the middle of the night, like 3, 4 a.m., which our hero, who I can't think of anything but James Stewart, but he's actually...
L.B. Jeffries, or Jeff to most people.
Jeff. It just starts watching and becomes... fascinated by the movements of this guy.
Yeah. I mean, he's already... I mean, to be fair, he's already perhaps got a little more fascinated than he ideally should be, but thinking, well, yeah, there is something actually wrong here.
Well, we have the lovely performance by Thelma Ritter as Stella, who's this guy, perhaps kind of...
actor I love to see, and she's great here. We have actually seen her in Riven of Means before.
Where was she?
She was the mother of the child in Milton on 34th Street who gets sent to the other store and is made happy thereby.
Oh, okay. A brief cameo.
She's much better here.
She's, I don't know, she's in some ways kind of slightly stereotypical.
Oh, yeah, it's a stereotype, hard-bitten, seen it all.
Yeah, but it's...
Frankly, given the nurses I've met, that's not completely implausible.
Well, a lot of stereotypes exist for a reason, and she's... great in it. And she's the one who basically is willing to come out and say, you're nuts for not going with your girlfriend, which is incredible. And why are you looking at all these people all the time? It's unhealthy. What's wrong with you? She's the one who will come out and say it.
But also in that first scene on her first visit that we see, it's just a lovely bit of physicality. The two of them together, they know the routine. They don't need to say, now you stand up and now you lie down on this table and so on. They just, this is how the routine goes. This is the point we're at. We just know it. We've been doing this for 6 weeks. It's lovely.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's looking for, he's actually, that's an important thing to say, he's towards the end of his thing, so he's already been in this situation for quite some time, which might explain why he's a bit grumpy and why he knows all the people already. But yes, there's a, that is much better than the psychiatrist at the end of Psycho. Visual storytelling, it's showing, not telling, but yes.
And I don't know, I wonder if possibly I wasn't paying the right sort of attention, but I got the impression that he had actually fallen asleep before the second trip out with the big bag.
I think
case.
We do, yeah. There's, I don't know if it's confusing or not, but there's clearly moments where he's dozing, and so it's not unusually for the film. Actually, it's not. Sometimes it's not actually entirely clear which bits he's seen and which bits he hasn't, because normally everything that he sees, we see. But there's a little grey area in that night.
There's certainly the assumption there after that he's aware that this has happened and is reasonably convinced by it. The thing that I found really noticeable at this point was the framing, which starts off, you know, it's just what he sees out of the window, obviously. But clearly, when you've got the whole of the window to look through, that's a wide shot. And when we're looking at the individual window to show what he's looking at, it's a narrow focal angle. But it's not the full yet.
Yes.
It's generally the middle ninth of the frame. Yeah, middle third.
Yes.
And I suspect, I mean, this was obviously filmed to be seen on a big screen where that would be obvious, not on a small laptopy screen. That's perhaps not ideal. I did end up watching this full screen on the laptop.
Yeah. Fair enough.
But even later on when he gets to, using binoculars or a zoom lens on a camera, it's vignetted. So there's that darkened round the edges. To show you that this, you're still not ever seeing the whole frame.
Yes, that's interestingly done. The other thing that becomes apparent quite is that the sound design is really interesting and well done. You know, there's a lot of ambient sound and it's confusing. The actual things are interesting. You actually get very little sound generally. It's all coming from around, which I quite enjoy. It adds to the realism because it's actually... It's a visually spectacular set, but probably because of the Technicolor, it doesn't feel that real, I suspect.
It was based on an actual real location.
Yeah, I mean, it's all plausible, but the sound design really helps to bring that, you know, we're getting a lot of sound coming in from around and it's, we don't focus in and it doesn't fade out all the other stuff when we're looking at these things going on. So,
I mean, it's very impressive. I think this may have been the biggest set Paramount had ever built at that time. It is actually an all-in-one.
Given that we're in one location the whole time, just looking at this set, it doesn't feel actually that confined or claustrophobic, which is a surprise because...
There is this large central courtyard with flowerbeds and things.
Yeah, I mean, it's lovely. It's great for people watching, as it turns out. So the plot progresses. Jeff becomes convinced that Thorwaldo's done away with his wife, who never again appears in the film. She was bedridden, then she disappears. He goes out with lots of suitcases, and that's enough for him to get a bit suspicious. Then Thorwald, always with the blinds open...
do I even need to invoke Roger's murder corner here?
I mean, his plan as it goes is not terrible. He's clearly thought it through and planned it for a while, unlike Marion Crane in Psycho. And he's just going through the motion. But he does it all in very plain sight and sends off this big box full of all her clothes off. It's planned to the point there's clearly another person involved. Because he's talking to them on the phone, presumably a lover.
The night of the murder, there is a woman involved in shifting some of the heavy stuff. Is it later? But she's shifting some of the heavy stuff anyway.
Yes. And he's arranged tickets for it, and he's arranged on a train. He's arranged for a postcard to come back to him saying, everything's well, I've not been murdered or anything. So he's clearly thought it through. His one flaw was doing it all in plain sight with the windows open.
Without which you don't get the film, so kind of...
Well, yeah, I mean, we have to have something going on.
And one of Jeff's friends is a police detective of some sort, and he suggests that he should take a look into this. And
yes.
The detective is quite reasonably saying, yeah, you got nothing. You got vague suggestions.
yeah, I can't just break into this place. I need a search warrant. And do you know how many murders are done? I slightly objected to the, oh, the stupidest idiot can do murders that are never detected. Well, I don't know. They're actually, most murders are really idiotically done and very easy to find out.
Well, I mean, that, by definition, we don't know about the murders that aren't detected. Maybe they're happening all the time.
Good point. Good point. That's like the cancers we get that are dealt with by our immune system. I wonder about that sometimes.
Yeah,
anyway.
I did think there was a missing phrase here because to modern me, the key phrase which everybody knows is fruit of the poison tree, i.e. if you do an illegal search, you are, not only are you not allowed to use the things you found on the search, you're not allowed to use the things you found out during that search to do legal searches elsewhere.
Exactly. It totally ruins your case because actually it makes it harder for you.
So. And that particular phrase starts in 1939. I mean, maybe it wasn't generally in use. Fair enough.
Was that America-wide or was that just in some states?
Well, first used in 39. I don't know how much it spread. And the doctrine was from 1920, but they didn't use the phrase for a bit. Anyway.
Right.
It just threw me slightly, but it may well be period accurate.
I do quite like Wendell Corey, who's the police officer, Tom. He's a very stereotypical kind of, but you're with him. You're kind of, although we're kind of on Jeff's side, you absolutely understand what the, like, Jeff's very rude to him, and they're clearly old friends, and he can get away with it.
But that's the thing also, and he is clearly havering about it, because on the one side, he knows perfectly well what police work is. On the other hand, he does trust Jeff. He doesn't think Jeff just makes things up. He's going to pay attention, even if he dismisses it.
So he plays this nice line, genuinely not just dismissing him out of hand and trying to meet him halfway, but also trying to explain, look, I can't do that. I think it's a really nice performance, and it helps to, it also, I guess the point of view from the audience is to pull them back. We're being dragged along with Jeff's kind of fantasy in a way, and he's supposed to come along and say, listen, just think about what you're saying. This is, you know, and it works. It pulls you back and it gives you some doubt and maybe Jeff's wrong. Because we've not seen anything explicit at this point. We've just seen some suspicious activity.
Mm.
And I think it works well. As far as suspense goes, again, this is not the first time I've seen this film. In fact, for a while, it was my favourite film ever. Seeing it again, and I've watched it a couple of times since I sort of decided it was my favourite film ever. It does take away a lot of the suspense and the intrigue, is it, isn't it? Because you sort of know where it's going. And that did, sadly, it devalues the film for a bit in my mind. It's hard for me to remember how much I enjoyed it the first time round, because I do enjoy it less on subsequent viewings.
Well, again, like Psycho, this is one I'd got from cultural osmosis, so I knew what was going to be rough, the broad outline of what was going to be happening, but not the details.
Yeah, this is one I watched as a kid, not knowing anything about it, which I think is why it blew me away. This time round, sorry, it moved into a broader description of the film, which I'll leave to the end. But yes, the suspense aspect of it works less on repeated viewings, I think.
That's fair enough. That's, okay, the cops aren't going to help. He's got to do something himself. But he can't. Yes. Fortunately, he has two very understanding women in his life who will do it for him.
He manages to convince both of them, particularly Lisa.
Once Lisa is convinced that there is a thing, she goes from the, clearly this is nothing, you're watching out of that window too much, to, okay, we've got to do something about this. She's more in favour of it, if anything, than he is.
Yes, absolutely. She becomes the woman of action. She is his proxy, and she's more than up to the task. Not at his asking. Whether she's determined to show him or whether she secretly wants to be that action girl, it doesn't matter. She really springs forward to the challenge.
And the proximate thing on this is that there's a dog that we've seen being lowered from an upper floor flat in a basket to go for its walk in the garden. And the dog turns up strangled, having been digging in the flower bed.
We have that lovely monologue of, well, a shouterlogue of her yelling at the audience. Kind of at the audience and everyone around. You just watch. You don't care. Neighbours used to be friends and now all you're doing is you're all murderers. Or it's a really nice scene. I don't know when the Kitty Genovese thing was.
A bit later.
Okay. I mean, I know that's all been debunked.
Early 70s, I think, but anyway.
But it's that kind of... and it slightly unsettles the audience as well that we've just been watching and enjoying. And I think this is where it becomes a more interesting comment and voyeurism as to, you know, how complicit I... Except...
Oh, 64, so 10 years after this.
Okay, so a little while after. But Kitty Genovese is a murder which was supposed to have kind of happened in front of many people who never did anything. They just sort of watched and didn't say anything. Actually... that's been largely debunked as that isn't quite what happened.
But it was certainly a cultural thing of that moment.
Yes. I suppose that the flip side of that voyeurism thing of what is your responsibility when you're just watching these things is that actually Jeff is desperately trying to do something but can't. You know, if he wasn't in his wheelchair with his broken leg, he probably would have just marched around and gone into Thorne's apartment himself. So I think that slightly undercuts the voyeurism aspect of it.
At the same time, I think one could say that, you know, everybody is telling him you're looking out of that window too much. I think one could reasonably say that he is looking for a thing to justify it.
Yes, that's true.
I'm not just watching that ballet dancer with the good taste in underwear. You know, I'm doing something useful here.
I'm performing a public service. And there's a nice bit where Lisa, Grace Kelly's character, says, you know, aren't we monsters? You know, we've just, after Tom has, the police detectives come around and basically said, come on, it's nonsense, wake up. They're both very deflated. And she then says, you know, aren't we monsters? We're sad because this murder hasn't happened. And the audience feels it too. You're a bit like, oh, what was the point of it then? That's a nice commentary on the situation. Again, it feels a bit superficial and trite, but it works in a film like this.
I mean, the obvious answer to you, the audience, you are monsters, is no, we came here to watch a film, and then you put this on the screen.
Exactly, yeah.
That's we're not just casually looking out the window and seeing it.
There have been a few other films that we've watched that have tried to do that, like, oh, and you watched it, what does that make you? And like, well, an unsuspecting victim in
$10 poorer.
Anyway, it's...
There's a lovely bit with Stella the nurse. They're talking about the flower bed, and the two women just spot, yes, of course, those flowers have changed, and that one's shorter than it should be. And Jeff is, what is this moon language you're talking?
Once the women are on board, things start happening because they distract Lars. They send Thorwald out on a wild goose chase while Lisa... so they climb down to look at the flower bed, don't find anything. So Lisa takes matters into her own hands and basically breaks into Lars's apartment. He left the windows open. So again, Roger's murder corner, don't do that.
Roger's crime prevention corner, which is not a thing I expected to happen.
And then we have, I think...
Well, there's one key bit here, which I was really glad to see paid off, because... Jeff has made the phone calls. He's got Lars out of the way, but he knows he's going to come back when nobody meets him at the lounge. Where, you know, he's basically saying, I know what you did. Pay me blackmail money, or hinting to that effect. So his job is to keep an eye on the alley, from which you can see a small slice of street.
Yes.
And say when Lars is coming back. And he doesn't. He's looking at the other things, same as he always has been. And, speaking as somebody who has had to keep watch on things, it's really hard, it's really boring. Yes. And indeed he misses it.
Literally what he's been... But even then, if he had seen, it's hard to know quite what he would have done.
He wasn't expecting Stella to go into the building. Yeah.
We get this great scene, which is kind of the core of the experience of the film in a way, that we then see from a distance this confrontation between Thorwald and Lisa. And we are pretty suspicious he's a murderer. It's going to get violent. And there's nothing we can do about it. And we're watching Jeff. So he has Stella by his side, I think, at this point. And they're both just, there's nothing they can do. They're beside themselves. And the tension built up from that dynamic is quite impressive, I feel. We just, not only are we voyeurs watching her being threatened by Thorwald, we're also watching Stella and Jeff distraught. And there's some good, you know, Jimmy Stewart, for all his being Jimmy Stewart, he does some really good, I'm helpless acting. You know, he's just clearly absolutely distressed by this situation.
Yeah, so... Thorwald finds Lisa, confronts her, and the answer that Jimmy Stewart comes up with in the moment is, I will call the police and say, you know, I'm seeing a woman being beaten up.
Yes.
And it's not clear completely whether that was his plan, but the effect of it is, and we see this in Dumb Show in effect, that the police turn up, they confront Thorwald, obviously says something along the lines of, yeah, she was breaking into my apartment and searching it.
Yeah, so they arrest her.
So they drag her off downtown. She has found, at some point during this, the wife's wedding ring.
Now, there is some very poorly aged stuff here from the 60s, which is like, Lisa's women's intuition of a woman would never do this, a woman would never leave a bag, and women are all entirely predictable and they all follow this path, and she's not doing it, therefore she's obviously been murdered. And one of the things is a woman would never leave her wedding ring behind, and that is the evidence that she's obviously been cut up and dumped in the East River.
There are people who never take their rings off to the point where they can't. I've spoken to ambulance people who have problems with this. They get really annoyed by a titanium wedding ring that the normal cutters won't go through. I have this titanium wedding ring here.
You can look forward to that then, or someone can. This is on the eve of the countercultural revolution, and I do believe there are women who don't follow the social norms. That, to be fair, she's probably right in this case.
But in any case, as she's being dragged off, she manages to show the ring to the window where she knows Jeff will see it.
Unfortunately,
but Thorwald sees her doing it.
Yes, and for the first time, for some reason, notices this guy in a wheelchair with binoculars. We never know what it looks like to them from the other side. We only ever see it from Jeff's point of view, so we never know how obvious he's been. Maybe everyone knows he's the square creep at this point. It's hard to know. But we get the impression most people haven't seen him or are not aware of him.
Yeah. And I was noticing earlier when he gets the zoom lens out that, yeah, lens glint is a real problem, guys.
Yeah.
you get a bit more of a hood on that thing. It was much less of a concern.
Thorwald sees it. Jeff belatedly turns the light off and sort of disappears into the half light, but it is too late because a few minutes later Thorwald, and he's left the door open as well. But Thorwald just opened. I wondered if he's going to batter the door down. No, he doesn't have to. He just opens it.
Yeah, I was expecting either smash it down, which would be entirely plausible, or maybe even pick the lock if he actually had that skill, which he probably doesn't. But no,
he doesn't have to worry about either.
I suppose you could argue that, you know, Lisa gets in whenever she wants to. Fair enough, and give her a key. Maybe he didn't want to give Stella a key, and he just leaves it open. I don't know. It doesn't entirely work.
We don't need it explained. It's just a bit of a surprise. We both thought that's an obstacle Thorwald's going to have to. Oh, he's okay. All right.
And Jeff holds him on by firing flash bulbs at him. Good classic flash bulbs.
Yeah, it's really not just the mechanics of the noise and the kind of the bulb dropping to the floor while he quickly has to screw in another one because he's ruined the bulb by doing the first flash. That's a really nice bit of cinematic history in a way, of photographic history. The effect is to slow Thorwald down by about 30 seconds, but it's still enough.
This is the first point, in fact, at which our viewpoint moves out of the apartment, and it's right at the end.
Thorwald does
eventually throw Jeff out of the window. But it's the classic hanging on and just dropping at the last moment. The police are there in time to catch him, but they just don't do a very good job of it.
No, he still wanted to stay at the ground. If Tom hadn't asked for his 38 the last minute, he would have made it in time. But there we go. Then Thorwald We get a very, this is a much better brief wrap up. We don't have then some police coroner turning up and saying, well, actually, Thorwald did. We have a very brief wrap up of, she was in the East River. Is it Stella that kind of does the explanation?
Yeah, cause Stella went up to the police station to bail Lisa out.
That's right. And she has a quick word with the, basically we have, Thorwald's ready to, confess everything. And we find out what was buried in the garden was a hat box, presumably with a Gwyneth Paltrow style head in it. It's filled it. It takes about, I don't know, 10 seconds to tell you, yes, everything you saw is true and he did cut her up and it, there we go.
Here I will admit, you know, you've got some bloody tools that will suggest that there might be a body. Lose them with the body. I mean, you've got a body disposal channel already. Use that.
He would have got away with it if it wasn't for meddling Jeff.
This film brought to you by American Blinds. Close your blinds.
He does have blinds. He just doesn't use them very much. So then Jeff is once again back in his apartment. Now with two broken legs, thankfully not his femur. He didn't bleed out from it. So it wasn't a compound open fracture of his femur. Anyway, doesn't matter. He's now got two broken legs and is stuck even more than he was before in a very easy but satisfying ending. So what was your overall feeling of Rear Window?
Well, there is just one thing that soured the ending a bit for me, which, you know, it has its happy resolution, but one of the other people he has been looking at in one of the ground floor flats is a woman who is, you know, moderately attractive, but perhaps getting on a bit. And
oh yes, we didn't talk about
living on her own, you know, doing things like setting up a gorgeous meal for presumably her and a partner, and then the partner doesn't turn up, you know, and drinking heavily.
Miss Lonelyheart.
Yeah, and she brings a guy back and kind of leaps on him. And he is repulsed and goes away for frankly no obvious reason, because I think she's not bad looking at all, but maybe I'm biased.
We don't know the conversation quality they've had. It might have been terrible. But yeah. Anyway, that's clearly not what he's
doing. But in any case, just as all the climactic things are happening, Stella, who is frankly the real hero of this film, notices what pills it is she's pouring out of the bottle. And it is clear that she is about to kill herself. And this is the point at which Jeff says, let's phone the police. And I wonder if the intention was to report that first.
You're right. That sort of gets lost in amongst the whole,
And then when he talks to the police, he's telling her about, you know, a woman is being beaten up in the apartment upstairs.
Yeah, he doesn't mention anything about her.
And as it turns out, just as she is about to down the fatal dose, she hears a snatch of music from the songwriter Up and Over, who has gone from clearly starving in his garret to now everybody loves him and everybody comes round and he has a great big party and so on. And she hears this snatch of song again and she is reminded that there is something to live for. And in one of the final scenes, She is in the apartment with him telling him how much his music has meant to her.
I think that's, yes, it's, everything is wrapped up very neatly and happily.
I mean, I don't mind that. Story. I do mind the, oh, well, let's completely forget about the woman committing suicide in the quest to save my girlfriend.
Well, that would have been a much darker film if then it just panned down to the empty apartment below and the guy coming in and painting her room too. Wow. Good point. They make no effort to save Miss Lonelyheart whatsoever, do they?
It wasn't the last few minutes of Psycho, but it did sour it for me slightly. Apart from that, I was very much enjoying it. So.
It's a very enjoyable film to watch, isn't it? As far as has it been widely imitated, I mean, it's been influential. I mean, it's been remade again with Christopher Reeve this time, post-accident. I haven't seen it, but it was a TV movie. Mm. It's been widely referenced and certainly influential on other directors. It's not had the same quite cultural phenomenon aspect of Psycho.
Well, but... I mean, with something like Psycho, we talked about this before a little, I think, that there are elements you can copy without making it a copy of the whole thing.
Yes.
And if you copy Rear Window, you either copy the whole guy stuck on his own seeing things, which, yes, as you say, has been done a few times, or you copy the whole wife murdering thing, which frankly has been done a lot, but it wasn't original here. The thing that's original here to copy is that setup.
That single set, which
and it very much constrains the sort of story you could tell.
I think, and probably has been done, though we haven't yet, it probably works better as a single episode of a TV series at this point, that the hero is suddenly trapped, and we've run out of budget, and let's do one of those episodes. I was slightly surprised. Rear Window was, as I say, for a time, my favourite film ever. I think just because I was so surprised when I saw it, it caught me at a time when I was getting into Hitchcock. I loved Jimmy Stewart. It was just, everything was perfect for me. And I was bowled over by it, and I thought it was fantastic. Unlike some of my other favourite films of all time, Jaws and The Man Who Would Be King, this one has aged a bit less well for me, and I'm a bit less... I find Jeff's personality a bit more grating, his rejection of Lisa a bit more, even though it's part of the plot, and the kind of the dated views of women grate on me a little bit. Shorn of the suspense aspect... it's still brilliant. I still find it very enjoyable, but it's not one of my favourite films of all time. In fact, it's probably not even my favourite Hitchcock anymore. But I do like it a lot. So many people just consider it as Red a masterpiece. It probably is.
Looking at it beside Psycho, I got more enjoyment out of this.
Yes, okay.
But at the same time, I might argue that Psycho is more of a technical masterpiece.
I mean, I would say, as you say, technically, the set of this is incredible. And to draw such a compelling narrative out of these constraints, I do think it's expertly done. Whether Hitchcock had to keep limiting himself in this way, and we'll talk about this more in a later episode, I suspect.
Yeah, there's one particular film which I think, not to spoil anything, because I won't say which film it is just yet, relies far too heavily on the gimmick.
We'll talk about it, but yes,
I mean, yes, it is clearly constrained by the gimmick, and the story is built up around the gimmick. And this is one of the few films that isn't an adaptation of a play or something, I believe.
No, I think it was a suggestion from a...
there was a short story.
Okay.
On the same general theme, but yeah. Yeah, I mean, I liked it. I think this may be because I put myself into the best I can manage of a 1954 mindset.
Yes, okay.
Because otherwise I would be screaming, just have a conversation like adults, you damn idiots.
Yes, I do. I think Psycho and Rear Window are probably examples of the very best Hitchcock has to offer. And as such, you know, as a commercial director, you can see why he's very successful. And he genuinely is a master of suspense in a similar way that I think Tarantino is. He's much better at the suspense than the graphic stuff later. Hitchcock never progresses to the graphic stuff, except maybe a bit in The Birds, and maybe in some of his later films. But I do think he's very good at building up tension. If nothing else, that moment when Lisa is confronted by Thorwald and there's nothing we can do about it, even though, as an audience, nothing we can ever do anyway, I think getting that kind of tension out of that scene is really impressive. So I think for me it is a masterpiece.
Yeah, I'll go along with that. I mean, I think it's easy to read too much into the voyeurism and then the I'm seeing it but I can't affect it. What does that make me? And so on. Yes, obvious thing is obvious, but I don't think that is the only thing the film has to say.
I think it's even the main thing. Bang on when you know, Hitchcock was not, we now think of him as an auteur and this great director. He was an artist and took it seriously, but he was not a tortured artist, this is my vision, and screw the audience, I'm going to do what I like. He was, no, this is what the audience are going to effing love. A bit like Spielberg in that respect, you know, he had his vision, he knew he was right, but he knew he was right because he knew the audience would love this rather than this is my artistic statement.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Right, well, I think that about wraps up our first double Hitchcock, and we will be back soon with another double Hitchcock.
Everybody gets a little crazy sometimes. Oh, 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 oh